Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 17th, 2024. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. And we'll begin this first hour with a front page article from the Republic about a Chinese restaurant. Then we'll move on to an article about the season of sharing. This first article is entitled The Many Lives of Chop Suey, with the subtitle New Garden Restaurant Has Served the Same American Chinese Food Since the 1940s, Establishing Generational Friendships Between the Owners and Diners. And this is by Rhea Lee. Mary Del Rio walked into New Garden Restaurant on a Friday afternoon in August with her husband and daughter. High windows of thick glass made it seem like the restaurant was underground, the cool air a relief from the sun beating down on the concrete outside. A jazz singer crooned softly in the background. Instead of sitting down in the booth with her family, Del Rio made a beeline for the kitchen. She pushed open the door, revealing the sounds of Cantonese conversation between the cooks, the sizzling of oil, and the metallic clang of large metal woks. "Where's Mama?" she asked, raising her voice to be heard over the noise. Run Quen Fang came out from behind a stove, wiping her hands on her red apron. "I haven't been in here for a while and thought I'd better come and say hi to you," Del Rio said. Fang chuckled, the laugh lines around her eyes deepening. "Okay," she said. The women hugged. Del Rio is 75. She's been coming to New Garden Restaurant since she was a teenager in South Phoenix. She knew the founder, Mary Tsai, who started the Chinese restaurant in the 1940s. Over the decades, she's befriended each relative who took over after Tsai, and now she's gotten to know Fang, whom she calls Mama. Fang prefers to stay in the kitchen and avoid interactions with customers because she only speaks a little English. But she makes an exception for visitors like Del Rio, whom she considers an old friend. "Sometimes we'll use sign language to communicate with each other," Fang said in Mandarin, which she speaks in addition to Cantonese. Del Rio is just one of the many connections the owners of New Garden Restaurant have formed with generations of customers in their neighborhood, a few blocks south of downtown Phoenix at Central Avenue and Hadley Street. Those connections have sustained the business for 80 years and allowed it to keep serving the same menu of Americanized Chinese food more or less unchanged since the 1940s. It all started with Mary Tsai. There's another thing that makes New Garden unique. It has stayed within the same large extended family, which continues to grow as new members immigrate from China. Cam Yi Tsai, known by many as Mary, founded the restaurant in the 1940s. In 1970, after her husband died, her relative Wing Kwong Ong stepped up to help run the business with his family. In 1985, they passed it off to Bill Kwan and his father Yancey, who are distantly related to Mary Tsai. Kwan started working there when he was 15 and officially took over the restaurant in 2000. In 2015, Kwan sold it to Run Quang Feng, her husband Gui Cheng Zhang, and her brother-in-law Tom Tang, who are still the owners in 2024. Kwan and Tang are related through Tang's uncle. Mary Tsai died in 2018, and according to Kwan, other family members, and longtime customers, she was not known or remembered for her customer service. "She was pretty spicy sometimes," Kwan said with a laugh. "A lot of customers say she's mean. She's like, 'What do you want?'" Del Rio said, lowering her voice to a gruff rumble. But far from hurting business, Tsai's manner actually seemed to help her connect with her customers. Kwan said people liked the way she talked because it mimicked their own no-nonsense manner. Many came to find it endearing. "It's a tough neighborhood. Not beating up other people, just tough with talking," Kwan said. By all accounts, Tsai had no choice. She had to be tough. Born in Phoenix but taken to China as a small child, Tang, who calls her his great aunt because she's his grandfather's sister-in-law, said he isn't sure exactly why or when she came back to the U.S. because his family didn't talk much about their history. What he does know is that before she turned 18, Tsai married Tang's great-uncle Jimmy, who was a lot older than she was. Together, they opened New Garden around 1942. After Say's husband died, Wing Kwan Ong, who was from the same village in China as Mary's family and had been working as a cook for the restaurant, bought part of the business, said Wing's son, Eddie Ong. The family moved from Hong Kong to Phoenix when he was very young. Eddie started working at the restaurant when he was just 10 years old. According to him, Say started the business, but his father Wing figured out how to make it profitable. Mary was making $13 a night, Eddie said. That's why he came up with all those innovations. Say and her husband developed a menu that they thought would appeal to American taste buds, since most of their customers were not Chinese. They took Cantonese recipes, already known for their light, mild taste compared to other regional Chinese cuisines, and tweaked them to make them even sweeter, explained Jason Feng, Tang's nephew who immigrated from Guangdong in 2009 and has worked at the restaurant for 7 years. But when Wing Ong got involved, he realized that the food, which cooks would make in big batches in the morning and keep warm in a massive steam table, looked unappetizing. So, New Garden started making food to order. While this is standard practice now, back then New Garden was one of the first Chinese restaurants to do so, Eddie Ong said. Tender pork noodles won the hearts of Phoenix diners. Wing also helped develop one of New Garden's most popular dishes, the pork noodles. 50 years later, Eddie Ong still remembers how they'd make it. When you order it, we'll put it in a bowl, soy sauce, a little bit of MSG, and then a little bit of pepper. Take the noodle, put it into that hot water just to soften it up, and put it back on. And then slice up the char siu, so you know the Chinese barbecue pork. Put half an egg in there, some green onion. We'd pour on the hot pork stock on it, Eddie said. Man, I'm still craving that stuff. Eddie's job was defrosting the noodles, which they bought from their friend and relative Samuel Hom, who still makes noodles at the age of 90. For Eddie's own dinner, he'd often eat the pork noodles, but he'd spice them up, using flavors and ingredients introduced to him by the restaurant's Black and Mexican clientele. I would put in a little Louisiana hot sauce, a little black pepper, and a little sesame seed oil, and then the dry jalapeno chili, Eddie said. On a dark, cold night, that's comfort food right there. Why are they selling burritos at a Chinese place? Mary Say and Wing also realized that Americans love fried food, which is how they came up with New Garden's signature item, a massive deep-fried egg roll, which is still served today. Our egg roll is fried. After the wrapper hardens, we dip it in batter and deep-fry it. Some people like it, some don't. The customers that are used to it, some of them that have eaten here 3 or 4 generations, they like those textures. They ate it when they were kids, Tang said. Del Rio remembers the day she figured out what it was. As a teenager in the 60s, she worked at a Mexican restaurant with her friend. After they got off work at midnight, they'd be ravenous. New Garden used to be open from 5 p.m. to the wee hours of the morning to serve the laborers who worked in the produce district and on the railroad. We didn't want Mexican food, so we'd come over here. We'd see the egg rolls, and we would always say, "What are those?" We thought, "Why are they selling burritos at a Chinese place?" Never ordered them because we liked the pork noodles. And then one day we figured out, "Oh, that's what it is, the egg rolls," Del Rio said. More than simply a novelty, the egg rolls were also an attempt to differentiate New Garden from the other Chinese restaurants selling the style of food that came to be known as chop suey. The many lives of chop suey. There are several myths surrounding the origin of chop suey, including a story about a Chinese diplomat who hosted a dinner party for Americans in New York and wanted a dish that would appeal to both palates. Outside of alluring invention tales, the consensus among historians is that chop suey is a variation on a southern Chinese stew-like dish made of meat, vegetables, and sauce. Chop suey literally means mixed in Chinese. It was a staple for early Chinese immigrants to the U.S. who came to work on the railroads in the late 19th century. At New Garden, customers got used to a particular recipe for the dish. Back then, it was defined as whatever meat and then celery, onion, and bean sprouts. You put anything else in it and customers go, "Ooh, that's not chop suey," Eddie Ong said. It somehow got standardized. Chop suey eventually became something that non-Chinese housewives in Phoenix whipped up. The Arizona Republican published multiple recipes for chop suey aimed at white housewives, including one made of pork, mushrooms, and celery, served over Kellogg's corn soya shred cereal instead of rice. A 1952 article described the dish as fragrant, spicy, and tongue-tantalizing, and suggested that it could help to keep husbands eating at home. Chop suey remained popular until the 1990s, when immigration from northern China became more prevalent, changing the food landscape, Kwan said. A series of events influenced the new wave of Chinese immigration, from the 1965 removal of immigration quotas in the U.S. to the 1989 massacre of student protesters in Tiananmen Square, which caused the American government to offer special immigration protections to Chinese citizens present in the U.S. The changing demographics combined with increased opportunities for the second and third generation children of restaurant owners meant that many chop suey houses in Phoenix shut down. Singhai Chop Suey House, a contemporary of New Garden, lasted for three generations but closed in 2018. "This is the last of it," Kwan said. "I think we're the only restaurant that still serves chop suey." New Garden finds new fans on TikTok. Derek and his twin brother, Edwin Fang, nephews of owner Run Quen Fang, started helping out over the summer before they went back to Arizona State University for their senior year. Run Fang needed the extra hands, as New Garden had been filled with crowds of customers, with up to 2-hour waits to be served, said Derek Fang. "There were 3 days in a row where we just sold out. People would come in with like an hour left, and I'm like, I'm sorry, there's no more ingredients left," Derek Fang said. The reason for the rush? A viral video. Diane Puro Guanajuato is a food influencer who makes videos trying different food spots around Arizona. She started on YouTube in 2017 and then moved to Instagram and TikTok, where she has 88,000 followers. On July 15th, she uploaded a video of her visit to New Garden. As of the time of writing, the Instagram video has 1.2 million views and 768 comments. The TikTok version, which is 9 minutes long, has 829,300 views and over 1,400 comments. Puro Guanajuato told the Arizona Republic that even though she's been to thousands of restaurants in her work, her experience at New Garden was unique, referring to both the restaurant itself and the reception to her videos. "The feeling was just like we all miss the old days," Puro Guanajuato said. "If you look in the comments on TikTok and Instagram, it was just an overpour of memories. Definitely, that was my best experience since I've been a foodie." Puro Guanajuato had the idea for the video when someone recommended the restaurant to her on social media. The name brought back a buried memory of a relative bringing her to New Garden when she was 15. She remembered entering the restaurant through the back door in the kitchen, a practice that New Garden has since had to discontinue because of health regulations. She credits New Garden for the outpouring of love and support the videos received. "I wouldn't say that I did it. It's more of they did it because the video was kind of like a reminder that they're still there. They haven't changed," she said. Her posts enticed new visitors like Monique Jones and Roger Wardell, who was born and raised in South Phoenix but had never been to New Garden. the giant egg rolls, 2 for $5. The crunch brought me here, Joan said. And yes, this is the best Chinese food that I've had since I've lived in Arizona. How did New Garden come to be known as Dirty Mary's? The comments on Puro Guanajuato's videos are heartwarming, with hundreds of people reminiscing about New Garden. But many of the commenters remember the restaurant by a different name, Maria Cochinas, or Dirty Mary's. My mom said I should have been born Asian because she ate there every day when she was pregnant with me in 75. She also told me that when she was a kid in the 50s, the neighborhood kids would go to Maria Cochinas when they closed, and they would give out extra food to everybody, user at edhizzle75 wrote on Instagram. Different stories have sprung up about how the business got its nickname. Puro Guanajuato said she learned from the comments the theory that the name was a literal description of the restaurant. Mary was so busy, like traffic would come in, so she didn't have enough time to get to all the tables to clean them up. Some people were kind of like, we don't care, we're going to push it to the side and order our food, Puro Guanajuato said. Del Rio agreed with this theory. The place was kind of run down for a long time. When you went in there, it was really, really dark. It just kind of looked dirty, she said. Quan remembers it differently. Cocina means kitchen in Spanish, so people used to call it Maria Cocina or Mary's Kitchen. Mary would say the same thing, but she said it in Chinese with an accent, so she said Cochina instead of Cocina, Quan said. And that was how they got it. Mama Fang may be the last in a long line of New Garden owners. Several generations have dedicated lifetimes to running the restaurant. After Mary Say and Wing Ong retired, Quan and his wife Lisa spent most of their lives running New Garden until they too decided that their bodies could no longer handle the hard work. Fang, the current chef and co-owner, was born in 1959 in Guangdong. She came to the U.S. in 2008, joining her father, who immigrated in 1985. She worked in different Chinese restaurants around Phoenix. When the chance to buy New Garden arose, she jumped at the opportunity to own her own restaurant. She's the main cook, a profession she learned from her father, who was a chef back in Guangdong. From a young age, Feng was responsible for feeding her brothers and sister. The oldest of four, she'd go home during school lunch break, which lasted 2 hours, and cook for them. Although she likes being the boss, it's gotten a lot more stressful with the construction of the light rail on Central Avenue right outside her business. There's a lot of pressure, Fang said. I've thought about closing. Customers have slowly started coming back, she said, and the business got a huge boost in the summer from Puro Guanajuato's video. And despite the stress and the difficulty of being in a hot kitchen all day, Fang has maintained her passion for running the restaurant. Of course I like it. If I didn't like it, what am I doing for so many years? She said, her eyes twinkling. Fang had to admit, though, that one day her time at New Garden will also come to an end. And right now, there are no new members of the extended Sei Ong Tang Fang clan to step in and take over. There's no family left in mainland China, Tang said. Everyone has built new lives in the U.S., Canada, and other countries around the globe. And the younger family members are more interested in careers outside the restaurant industry. It's definitely humbling to see my family has been working hard for so long, Edwin Fang said. Even though we're not going into the restaurant business, I feel like they'd be proud of our passion, which is engineering. Eddie Ong, who went on to earn his PhD in chemistry and is a professor at Phoenix College, would not wish his experience on the new generation anyway. He worked at New Garden from age 10 to 26, juggling school with full shifts there. No childhood, Eddie said. You're an immigrant. It's demanded of you. Although he's nostalgic about the restaurant now, he's glad twins Edwin and Derek Fang are able to pursue whatever careers they want. New Garden is truly a taste of the past. Originally one of hundreds of mom-and-pop restaurants lining the streets of Phoenix, New Garden Restaurant is one of the last of its kind, last chop suey house, last remnant of the Chinese immigrants who settled in the warehouse district south of downtown. During my time there, it was more like a community kitchen, Kwan said. He knew his customers by name and didn't even need to take their order to know what they wanted. Longtime customers treat New Garden as a living memorial to the history of Phoenix. They take their children or even grandchildren to reminisce about the old days when the lots north of the restaurant were just empty desert and the streets were made of dirt. And of course, to introduce the next generation to the food of their childhood. As for Feng, tucked away in the kitchen with huge sizzling steel woks, she'll keep New Garden going for as long as she can, before her body too, like the generations of owners before her, tells her it's time to rest. And that article was entitled The Many Lives of Chop Suey, and that was by Rhea Lee. And now, in this approaching holiday season, this next article is about the season of sharing, entitled Season for Sharing Returns to Help Arizonans in Need. This is by Sylvia Solis and Greg Burton. In a presidential election year and with wars abroad consuming our attention, it's easy to lose track of vital interests closer to home. But we must never forget that for whatever reason, some of our friends and neighbors struggle with unexpected personal setbacks, difficult transitions through the stages of life, learning, and higher costs of living. While politics can divide us, Arizonans have always worked together to fill gaps at the ground level of our community. Once again this year, the Arizona Republic and its loyal subscribers ask you to unite with us for another season of sharing. Last year, more than 160 local nonprofits received funding from the Season for Sharing campaign. We raised $1.6 million, bringing the total funds raised to over $74 million since the campaign began 31 years ago. With this funding, A New Leaf provides crisis and supportive services to almost 4,000 survivors of domestic and sexual violence, and the Arizona Opera provides over 40,000 K-12 students and educators across the state with free arts programming. What else? Season for Sharing dollars supports Central Arizona Shelter Services in providing 32,000 nights of shelter to families experiencing homelessness and funds St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance to provide food for 150,000 meals to improve the health and well-being of low-income children, seniors, and adults in Maricopa County. There are dozens of other examples of programs and services that make a meaningful impact on the daily lives of children, families, and older adults. The incredible impact is possible thanks to you. Your generosity has allowed us to fulfill our mission to give back to our communities and support the essential work local nonprofits do. Your contributions, no matter the size, make a significant difference. The 2024-25 grant cycle has opened the doors wider than ever by removing some eligibility requirements and inviting a broader range of organizations to participate. Over the next 2 months, our reporters will highlight the groups tirelessly serving Arizona families and showcase the individuals whose lives they have impacted. We invite you to be part of this impactful journey. Join us again in making a difference as we roll out this year's campaign. You'll see ads and prompts to text, mail, or scan in a donation. Most Season for Sharing contributions come from individuals who write checks ranging from $5 to $500 or more annually. This year, we can match donations 50 cents on the dollar up to $100,000 thanks to gifts from the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust. Along with our partners at the Pulliam Charitable Trust and Arizona Community Foundation, we urge you to join us for this campaign. The need remains great, and 100% of our united efforts benefit the people and institutions of Arizona. How to donate? Donate to Season for Sharing by texting SHARE to 91-999 or donating online at sharing.azcentral.com. That article is entitled Season for Sharing Returns to Help Arizonans in Need, and that was by Sylvia Solis and Greg Burton. Moving on to articles from Valley and State section of the paper. This one is in the section about the faces of Arizona, entitled Scholar Finds Truths in Scary Movies, and this is by Jose R. Gonzalez. Cemeteries were a common stomping ground for Orcadia Morales as a girl when helping gather graveyard dirt for her rituals her aunt carried out as a bruja or witch. She regularly leaned into the spooky while growing up along the U.S.-Mexico border near the mouth of the Rio Grande. A central part of her life was watching scary movies from Hollywood dubbed in Spanish and listening to Mexican folktales. I love horror, Morales said with a laugh in an interview with the Arizona Republic. The 39-year-old is in her second year as an assistant professor at the University of Arizona School of Theater, Film, and Television, and approaches horror as a fan and academic, defining the genre as filmmaking that elicits uncomfortable, visceral reactions. Morales also uses analysis and criticism to expose the Hollywood horror industry factors that purposely or not demonize Latinas. She teaches her 50 to 75 students a semester at UA about the horror genre's real-life implications. Horror cinema allows for so much in between, for so much flexibility, and that's why we should take it seriously. It tells us a lot of truth, Morales said. It helps us deal with fears that we don't know how to process otherwise. She points to the critically lauded 2019 Spanish-language film La Llorona. The film's director, Jairo Bustamante, seizes on the centuries-old Mexican-rooted cautionary tale about a woman drowning her children and transforms her into an avenging angel of death for war crimes. Bustamante's creative choice in La Llorona confronts the audience with the genocide of Mayans during the 1960 to 1996 Guatemalan Civil War, she explained. It's so much easier to talk about difficult topics, racism, all that sort of stuff, through horror movies because they affect people emotionally, Morales said, adding viewers become vulnerable and talk about these topics more comfortably. The dissertation that earned her a doctorate in American Studies from the University of Michigan dealt with gender-based violence along the U.S.-Mexico border through a horror lens. Horror is a preferred genre among Latino moviegoers, which is why the disparity in Latina representation is so upsetting for Morales. UCLA's most recent Hollywood diversity report found people identified as Latinx made up only 2.3% of the share of 2022 theatrical film leads compared to the 78.4% share held by whites. That's what's so annoying, Morales said, about the lack of visibility among Latinos in the genre, despite the community's support for it. Teaching is a long-held passion for Morales. My job allows me to keep learning while also sharing the information that I have, and I can't think of anything better to do, Morales said. And that article was entitled Scholar Finds Truths in Scary Movies, and that was by Jose R. Gonzalez. We're almost 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 17th, 2024. Continuing on now with Valley and State News, this next article is entitled Why Phoenix Ranked Among the 15 Coolest U.S. Cities. This is by Laura Daniela Sepulveda. Phoenix cracked a list of the coolest cities in the U.S. and Canada, shining for its diverse cultural landscape, recreation spaces, and technology-driven growth, a new study says. The study, from sportsbook site Canada Sports Betting, analyzed 50 of the most populous cities in both countries using 8 key categories: cultural and art scene, lifestyle and recreation, population, dining and nightlife, social and community engagement, tech and connectivity, environmental sustainability, and trendiness and media coverage. Analysts combined scores on all categories to assign each city an index with a top score of 100. The higher the score, the cooler the city. At number 15, Phoenix ranked high in the lifestyle and recreation, tech and connectivity, and cultural and arts categories. New York City ranked first. The city rated highest in the lifestyle and recreation category. The number of upcoming sports events was the factor that was most heavily weighted in the study, but other factors such as the number of green spaces and thrift shops in the city were also considered. Phoenix also scored well in the tech and connectivity category. The city's growing tech industry and robust infrastructure helped the city rank higher, according to the study. The city's cultural and arts landscape were also highlighted. The number of historical places in the city was weighted most heavily in this category. Phoenix also did not stand far behind in the dining and nightlife category compared to other cities. Phoenix showcases a world-class food scene, the study said. The city's diverse food landscape combines various international cuisines, standing out for the influence of Mexican gastronomy in particular. The city ranked lowest for environmental sustainability and trendiness. And that article is entitled, Why Phoenix Ranked Among the 15 Coolest U.S. Cities. And that was by Laura Daniela Sepulveda. Our next article is entitled, Report Finds Long List of Faults at Havasup High School. This is by Erlissa D. Bacenti. Havasup High Elementary School in the remote Havasup High Village at the bottom of the Grand Canyon has been cited with 252 deficiencies identified from 2021 to 2023, according to the Bureau of Indian Education. A new report concluded that, as the first school selected for the Bureau of Indian Education's 2023 Safety and Health Inspections, Havasup High also had major repeated deficiencies from the previous annual inspections that remained unaddressed, and corrections were not completed within the school's abatement plan timelines. Part of the U.S. Department of the Interior's mission is honoring its trust responsibilities or special commitments to American Indians, including providing quality education opportunities to children, the report said. Inspectors found a range of issues, including safety risks on playgrounds, non-working cooling and heating systems, staffing shortages, and a crumbling roof that required someone to reattach broken pieces by hand. Each deficiency identified during the inspection is classified by the most severe potential consequence of a hazard: catastrophic, critical, significant, or minor. While the school had addressed some deficiencies identified in 2021, 2022, and 2023, many remained unresolved, and those that were resolved were not completed in a timely manner. Most of the deficiencies fell within the significant category, with none classified as catastrophic. The Bureau of Indian Education is responsible for performing annual safety and health inspections at all Indian schools to identify deficiencies, and each school is required to correct those deficiencies and develop a comprehensive emergency management program to provide a safe school environment for students and staff, the report said. The Arizona Republic reached out repeatedly to the Bureau of Indian Education and Havasup High Tribal Government, but received no response. The deficiencies identified include significant staffing shortages, with vacant positions such as the principal, 18 teachers, a nurse, a librarian, and a maintenance worker, accounting for approximately 53% of the staff at Havasup High Elementary School. The Republic reached out to the current principal, Dr. Hoi Mi Winder, who responded quickly, stating all media requests should be directed to the BIE. The number of critical deficiencies at Havasupai Elementary School, which could result in serious injuries, rose from 9 in fiscal year 2021 to 23 in 2023. Of those, 21 were repeat issues. During an October 2023 visit, BIE found that 7 deficiencies remained unresolved. Within the critical classification, there were 23 issues cited, but 21 of these were repeated deficiencies from years past. After the inspection, Havasupai Elementary School notified BIE that 2 of the 7 deficiencies, both repeat deficiencies since 2019, had been corrected. Given the remote location of the school and limited medical services, it is particularly important that the school ensure compliance with standards that are intended to minimize students' risk of injury, the report said. After inspection, the school informed BIE that 2 repeat deficiencies from 2019 were corrected, with a written emergency plan developed and updated by December 2023. None of the corrected deficiencies had been resolved within their original timelines. BIE found that 202 of 208 significant deficiencies, which are regarded as having consequences that may lead to hospitalization for minor injuries or illnesses, were repeated infractions that were reported in the fiscal year 2023 Safety and Health Report. From a sample of 31 deficiencies, 10 were still uncorrected as of an October 2023 site visit. None of the corrected deficiencies were addressed within their original abatement periods. For instance, of the 21 corrected issues, 4 were identified in 2018 with abatement periods of 45 to 365 days, but were not resolved until 2023. And that article is entitled, Report Finds Long List of Faults at Havasupai School, and that was by Arlissa D. Bicenti. This next article is entitled, Why Ozone Season Ran Long in Maricopa County This Year. This is by Austin Corona. While ozone pollution is typically a summer phenomenon in Maricopa County, ozone season stretched well into the fall this year. High ozone levels usually drop off in mid-September, but Maricopa County broke federal ozone standards as late as October 12th in 2024. It was the first year the county has recorded any ozone exceedances in October since new air quality standards went into effect in 2015. Phoenix area ozone levels broke federal air quality standards 4 times in October. The exceedances happened in Mesa, West Phoenix, and Glendale. So-called ozone season in the Phoenix area typically runs from April to September. Concentrations of surface-level ozone, an air pollutant that contributes to respiratory and heart issues, repeatedly surpassed federal air quality standards over that period. The October exceedances bump Maricopa County up to 46 exceedance days in 2024. A region with more than 12 exceedances over a 3-year period falls out of compliance with regulations established under the Clean Air Act. In the 3 years between 2022 and 2025, Maricopa County has recorded 136 exceedance days. The ozone season spilled into historically hot October, signifying another potential consequence of long, hot summers in the Phoenix area. County officials have not called out heat as the culprit behind October ozone events, but researchers have generally pointed to heat as a major factor in ozone levels. Phoenix, which the American Lung Association ranked as the country's 5th most ozone-polluted city in 2023, is part of a federally designated non-attainment area, meaning it is out of compliance with current federal ozone standards. While Maricopa County's ozone levels have dropped moderately since 1990, regional efforts to reduce the Phoenix area's ozone concentrations have not been enough to bring the area into compliance. Ozone needs heat, but it's more complicated. Ozone forms when sunlight drives chemical reactions between airborne compounds released by plants, gas-powered vehicles, fires, and industrial facilities. The exceedance days all occurred during a streak of record-breaking high daily temperatures in early October. Experts say ozone does best in hot, sunny weather, with some saying temperature is the biggest driver in ozone creation. Heat amplifies ozone production in multiple distinct ways. Warmer weather speeds up atmospheric chemical reactions that produce ozone, creates stagnant air, and causes some plants to release more of the chemicals in those reactions. In general, Maricopa County officials say days with sunny, stagnant weather at 105 to 110 degrees create the best conditions for ozone. Nonetheless, air quality officials at Maricopa County would not attribute October's ozone exceedances to the heat wave. Officials cautioned that ozone formation is a complex process with many factors, saying they cannot be sure that the hot fall was the driving factor in October's exceedances. It is not possible to give a simple, accurate reason for high ozone days continuing later into the year, a spokesperson from the county wrote in an email. That was a heat wave, but what about climate change? Researchers agree that temperature is a main driver in ozone formation, largely because of the sunny weather and stagnation that come with it. That said, the future of ozone formation under rising temperatures may not be so simple to predict. One complicating factor in ozone's relationship with heat is ozone leveling. In some cases, scientists have noticed that ozone levels can plateau at high temperatures. According to Loretta Mickley, co-leader of the Atmospheric Chemistry Modeling Group at Harvard University, clear skies and stagnant air may already be maximizing ozone production in Arizona, meaning simple rises in temperature don't create much more. Mickley calls that phenomenon ozone leveling, though some scientists call it ozone suppression. The temperatures keep ramping up, 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 and ozone levels are high, but they're not budging, Mickley said. Suppression sounds like it's keeping ozone in check, but it's not really a suppression. It's more like an ozone leveling. This phenomenon complicates how scientists predict the effects of heat on Arizona's ozone problem in the future, with some models even showing decreases in ozone concentrations in different parts of the state as temperatures warm. Ongoing scientific debates about the way plants respond to increased temperatures could also change how scientists view the relationship between heat and ozone. Scientists agree, however, that wildfires driven by a warmer, drier climate will almost certainly exacerbate ozone levels around the country. Wood smoke contains compounds that react to form ozone under stagnant, sunny conditions. Areas downwind of those fires can suffer from increased ozone-causing pollutants mixing in their local atmosphere, according to Anna Rappold, a pollution researcher at the Environmental Protection Agency. A lot of volatile compounds can get transported across the nation, Rappold said. If there's a fire in Arizona, you could have ozone exceedances as far away as Houston or even New York. According to Mickley, many of the models testing the direct results of temperature changes on ozone do not account for the effects of wildfires. Those include the models showing decreases in ozone levels in Arizona. A lot of these projections of ozone into the future assume that fire will stay about constant, Mickley said. It's a problem. And that article was entitled, Why Ozone Season Ran Long in Maricopa County This Year. And that was by Austin Corona. Now, in our remaining time in this first hour of the Arizona Republic, we're going to turn now to national and world news with articles from USA Today, with two front-page articles, one about China, one about Russia. This first one is entitled, Xi Meets Biden for Final Time, with the subtitle, China's Leader Vows to Work with Trump Team. This is by Jarrett Renshaw and Lucinda Elliott and Eduardo Baptista and Trevor Honeycutt. Chinese President Xi Jinping on Saturday vowed to work with the incoming U.S. administration of President-elect Donald Trump as he held his final talks with outgoing President Joe Biden on key conflicts from cybercrime to trade, Taiwan, and Russia. Biden met Xi for about 2 hours at a hotel where the Chinese leader was staying on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Lima, Peru, for their first talks in 7 months. China's goal of a stable, healthy, and sustainable China-U.S. relationship remains unchanged following the election, Xi said, acknowledging ups and downs between the countries. China is ready to work with the new U.S. administration to maintain communication, expand cooperation, and manage differences. Biden told Xi that the two leaders haven't always agreed, but their discussions have been frank and candid. The talks come 2 months before Trump assumes office. He has vowed to adopt blanket 60% tariffs on U.S. imports of Chinese goods as part of a package of America First trade measures. Beijing opposes those steps. The Republican president-elect also plans to hire several hawkish voices on China in senior roles, including U.S. Senator Marco Rubio as Secretary of State and Representative Mike Waltz as National Security Advisor. Biden has aimed to lower tensions with China, but Washington is incensed by a recent China-linked hack of the telephone communications of U.S. government and presidential campaign officials, and it is anxious about increasing pressure by Beijing on Taiwan and Chinese support for Russia. Taiwan President Lai Ching-te is planning to stop in Hawaii and maybe Guam on a sensitive visit that is sure to anger Beijing in the coming weeks, Reuters reported on Friday. Meanwhile, Taiwan's former economy minister Lin Sun-yi met Biden at the summit on Friday and invited him to visit Taiwan in the near future. China views democratically governed Taiwan as its own territory. The U.S. is Taiwan's most important international backer and arms supplier, despite the lack of formal diplomatic recognition. Biden also wants China's help with North Korea, whose deepening ties with Russia and deployment of troops in the war with Ukraine has worried Washington. China's economic hit. At the same time, Beijing's economy is taking a stiff hit from Biden's steps on trade, including a plan to restrict U.S. investment in Chinese artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and semiconductors, and export restrictions on high-end computer chips. All of those topics are expected to figure into the talks, U.S. officials said. China routinely denies U.S. hacking allegations, regards Taiwan as internal matter, and has protested American statements on Sino-Russian trade. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington declined to comment. When the two countries treat each other as partner and friend, seek common ground while shelving differences, and help each other succeed, our relationship would make considerable progress, Xi said as he met with Biden, according to a simultaneous translation. But if we take each other as rivals or adversary, pursue vicious competition, and seek to hurt each other, we would roil the relationship or even set it back. On Wednesday, Biden National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan described the transition as a time when competitors and adversaries can possibly see opportunity. Biden is stressing with Xi the need to maintain stability, clarity, predictability through this transition between the United States and China. Zhen Dingli, a Shanghai-based international relations scholar, said China wants the meeting to ease tensions during the transition period. China definitely does not want relationships with the United States to be thrown into turmoil before Trump formally takes office, Shen said. Pacific Rim leaders gathered at the APEC summit are assessing the implications of Trump's return to power as U.S. president on January 20th. The South American summit offers new signs of the challenges to the United States' power in its own backyard, where China is on a charm offensive. Xi, who arrived in Lima on Thursday, plans a week-long diplomatic blitz in Latin America that includes a refurbished free trade agreement with Peru, inaugurating the massive Chancay deepwater port there and being welcomed in Brazil's capital next week for a state visit. China also announced plans to host the APEC summit in 2026. China is seeking Latin America's metal ores, soybeans, and other commodities, but U.S. officials worry they may also be looking for new U.S.-adjacent military and intelligence outposts. Chinese state-backed media has called those accusations a smear. A U.S. official said Washington's commitment to the region was strong, and that Chinese infrastructure investment overseas has declined in recent years due to domestic challenges and problems with the projects. But Ryan Berg, director of the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank, said Xi would meet with a good reception in the region. Biden's trip will be overshadowed very clearly by all of the things that Xi Jinping will be up to when he visits APEC, he said. When Xi meets with Biden, part of his audience is not, it's not solely the White House or the U.S. government. It's about American CEOs and continued U.S. investment or trying to renew U.S. investment in China and get rid of the perception that there's a hostile business environment in China. And that article was entitled Xi Meets Biden for Final Time. That was by Jarrett Renshaw and Lucinda Elliott and Eduardo Baptista and Trevor Honeycutt. Now, the next front page article from USA Today is about Russia. It is entitled Denounced Over Dissent in Russia, with the subtitle Doctor Among Those Who Have Been Accused or Jailed for Comments About Ukraine War. This is by Mark Trevelyan. On the last day of January, a woman took her son to see pediatrician Nadezhda Bayanova at Polyclinic No. 140 in northwest Moscow. The 7-year-old boy had a problem with one of his eyes. The conversation that the boy's mother alleged took place during an 18-minute encounter at the clinic would change both women's lives and land the 68-year-old doctor in prison. The case hinged on a denunciation, part of a rising trend of Russians informing on fellow citizens for their views on the war in Ukraine and other alleged political crimes. Critics say the wave of denunciations is helping President Vladimir Putin's government crack down on dissent. In a video recorded as she was walking away from the clinic, the mother, Anastasia Akinshina, said she had told the doctor the boy was traumatized because his father was killed fighting for Russia in the war in Ukraine. Do you know what she told me? Well, my dear, what do you expect? Your husband was a legitimate target of Ukraine, Akinshina said. Fighting back tears, Akinshina said she had raised the incident with the hospital administration and suspected they planned to hush it up. So the question is, where can I complain about this expletive now so that she'll be kicked out of the expletive country or sent to the devil in jail, she said in the video, which went viral on social media and thrust her into a high-profile criminal trial as the key prosecution witness. At the trial, Bayanova denied making the comment. But despite a lack of further witnesses, the denunciation was sufficient to destroy her 40-year medical career and her life. The doctor, who had been in pretrial detention since April, appeared before a Moscow court on Tuesday, her gray hair closely cropped. She was found guilty under a wartime censorship law of publicly spreading deliberately false information about the armed forces and sentenced to 5.5 years in a penal colony. Bayanova was born in Ukraine but is a citizen of Russia, where she has lived and worked for 3 decades. Her lawyer, Oskar Chirzhayev, told Reuters the defense believed Akinshina acted out of malice because of the doctor's Ukrainian origins. Akinshina did not respond to written questions or answer her phone. At the trial, she said, "We are Russian. Bayanova hates Russians. She feels hostility toward me. That's what I think," according to a transcript by independent Russian outlet Mediazona. 2 hospital staff who saw Akinshina after the consultation with Bayanova described her in evidence as being distraught. The prosecution's case was based almost entirely on Akinshina's account, along with a transcript read out in the trial of an interview with the child, conducted by an officer of the FSB Security Service. At first, Akinshina said the boy was not in the room when the comments were made, but later changed her story, telling the court she originally spoke in a state of shock. The judge rejected the defense's request to put its own questions to the child. Russian rights group OVD Info has recorded 21 criminal prosecutions in politically motivated cases based on denunciations since the launch of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Eva Levenberg, a lawyer with the group, told Reuters. Levenberg, who lives in Germany, said OVD Info knew of a further 175 people who had faced lower-level administrative charges for discrediting the Russian army as a result of people informing on them in the same period, and 79 of these had been fined. Reuters was unable to independently confirm the numbers Levenberg provided. Russia's Justice Ministry did not respond to requests for comment. In response to a question posed by Reuters, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the Kremlin does not comment on court rulings. Putin has said the country is in a proxy war with the West, and citizens need to help root out internal enemies. In March 2022, weeks after the invasion, he declared that the Russian people will always be able to distinguish the true patriots from the scum and the traitors, and just spit them out like a gnat that accidentally flew into their mouths. Since the start of the Ukraine war, according to OVD Info, the authorities have detained more than 20,000 people for various forms of anti-war statements or protests and launched criminal cases against 1,094 individuals. In news reports, court cases, and on social media, examples have come to light of neighbor informing on neighbor, churchgoers denouncing priests, and students reporting on teachers. And that is all the time that we have for with this article in the first hour of the Arizona Republic. This was entitled Denounced Over Dissent in Russia, and that was by Mark Trevelyan. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 17th, 2024. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.